This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. It's our weekly review of local news. Later in the show, we'll discuss top local stories, including how Cincinnati plans to become a smart city and what passage of the 3-foot law is going to mean for bicyclists and drivers. We'll also hear about the week's top business stories. First up, the Cincinnati area has again seen a spike in drug overdoses. Joining us to talk about it, Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter Terry DeMeo. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Terry.
Good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. You know, this is such a troubling story that you've been covering. How many people recently have overdosed in this latest spike?
Well, crushing blow. We had, over the weekend, a total of 121 people in Hamilton County and the northern Kentucky counties that feed into St. Elizabeth Hospitals. We do not yet have information on how many died, but we know that the majority were saved again by naloxone, which is the antidote for opioid and heroin overdose.
How does this compare to, I hate to use the word normal in this case, but how does this compare to what the overdose numbers normally run, Terry?
Well, we can say for sure that prior to the big carfentanyl, you know, the big carfentanyl explosion in August, that Greater Cincinnati was having about 3 to 4 overdoses a day end up in hospitals. And what I've learned this week is that as of Wednesday, there were 662 hospital admissions and 953 EMT dispatches in Hamilton County, since January. And that average, or those averages, are 8 per day or 12 per day. So we may occasionally get back to what was normal for us in this area 6 or 7 months ago. However, it's still running high.
So if I heard you right, Terry, that daily number is anywhere from double to triple what it normally would be.
That's correct.
Did you look at other numbers for any of the other counties around the Cincinnati area?
I really haven't seen them all. I have an indication that Butler County was hit, and I'm confident, if that's the right word, that to say that this is occurring all over Greater Cincinnati, because as a Shell cruise camp from St. Elizabeth says, as Hamilton goes, so do we. And that's 3 of the counties in northern Kentucky.
You know, it seemed like things had quieted down since that surge of ODs that occurred back in the summer. How surprised were local officials by this surge?
You know, I can't say that they were surprised. I think they're at a point where they always brace for the possibility that this will happen. And both the Hamilton County Heroin Coalition and the Cincinnati Police Department, and the city of Cincinnati, I guess I should say, have eyed up overdoses in real time now for several months. So they, you know, they wait for it. They're not shocked when it occurs. Just disappointed.
What's caused this? Any ideas? What led to this?
I don't know. Excuse me, that it has to do with the time of year, although that's always a possibility. But by and large, it is that fentanyl is so common now in our heroin stream and sold separately by itself. You know, fentanyl is about 50 times stronger than heroin itself, and some people are still buying it unwittingly. Others are, there's actually a market for fentanyl, because if you are a long-term user and you're getting sick every time you come off of the heroin or the opioid that you're on, you aren't getting back that euphoria that you were way at the beginning of the use, but you're just miserable. and you want something that will take that pain away.
So fentanyl, it's also, there's carfentanil as well, right? Which I think is even more potent than fentanyl.
It's much, much more potent.
I think it's like 10,000 times more potent than heroin is what I've heard.
That is correct. And carfentanil is in and out of the area, too. It's certainly not seen at the same rate as fentanyl is. But basically, you're seeing all kinds of analogs of fentanyl. Dr. Smart with the Hamilton County coroner has seen a few other rogue fentanyls in the heroin stream that comes through our area. And this means that manufacturers who are more like, I guess they call them bucket manufacturers in other countries such as China, are just mixing it in or making it and, you know, delivering it over here. And it winds up within our heroin supply or sometimes, you know, sold separately.
Terry, at this point, though, they haven't said for sure whether it's fentanyl and carfentanil, have they? This is just their suspicion, yes. Right?
That is correct. That's absolutely right. I just spoke with Dr. Simarco, and she noted that toxicology tests take a long time. And even when we talk of these folks who have overdosed, what we really should be saying is that it's suspected overdoses, because until it's identified, you know, specifically why they overdosed, it's still a suspicion, although because we have so many survivors and so many people who will tell nurses and doctors in the ERs that this is what it was, we know it's, you know, we do know that it's an overdose surge.
Do they think this is going to continue, Terry, that we're going to continue to see this kind of pace?
I think, in talking with some of the officials in Hamilton County that are watching this closely, they do not think so, but nobody knows, you know, when it will. I guess it's slowed down somewhat during the week, but you just don't know when there's going to be another surge like this. And the whole thing is that people are not getting treated for heroin addiction or opioid addiction after they have overdosed. I know there are some that are, but our emergency rooms right now, in general, are not equipped to, you know, handle addiction cases after that emergency point.
And how are local first responders doing handling this?
They're busy. I understand that there is some frustration. I have seen a lot more, I don't know if it's compassion or resignation, to their role in this epidemic. Obviously, emergency responders who are paramedics and medical technicians are used to, you know, working on people to save their life. And it's a little more normal or common for them. But then we have police officers on the street who have carried Narcan. I've actually seen, over time, a lot more acceptance of that and willingness to do it, as well as some police officers who will say, I want to do this. This is part of my role, to protect and save people's lives. So they're doing it. There's no question that they are tired of the situation.
And speaking of carrying Narcan, are health officials saying that more people should be carrying Narcan?
Yeah, they should, according to health officials. And the CDC and Ohio Department of Health people have recommended that people get it. Around here, what I've mostly seen is that anyone who has a relative friend or she or he himself uses heroin or opioids, and anyone who has been prescribed opioids, pain relievers, should have it, as well as, you know, officials, including police and fire, of course. But nationwide, I'm hearing more, let's just get Narcan in everyone's hands, and I carry it.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. We have a call that's coming in anonymously. This is someone who is a current addict and who wants to talk about this. And good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on a couple things. I believe part of the increased use that we are seeing is a direct result of the new CDC guidelines in regards to prescribing opiates and opioids. They've recently reduced the amount doctors are able to prescribe, and that's pushing people towards heroin, because when you have somebody that's been on long-term opiates and all of a sudden they're cut off from their pain management through no fault of their own, they're not just going to stop. They're going to go somewhere. Also, in regards to fentanyl, when people are arrested, instead of getting them help, they're thrown in jail, and that doesn't help anybody. Or they're thrown in jail for 30 days, and they get out, and they use again, and then they OD because their tolerance have gone down. Well, when they're put in jail and they're put on probation, one of the easiest ways to keep using is to use one of the fentanyl analogs, butrafentanil, acetafentanil, because it does not come up in drug tests. So it's a way around a probation drug test.
Now you say you're currently an addict. What would it take for you to stop?
I honestly, I don't know right now.
Yeah.
I've quit for periods of time, and you know, I'm actually successful. Like, I'm very successful in my job. I own my car, my house, everything. I guess I would be a functioning addict, but I honestly don't know what would make me stop at this point.
Okay. Let's let Terry chime in on this, too. Thank you so much for the call, and best to you. Let's let Terry chime in on this, and what are your thoughts, Terry?
Yeah. Well, I think, there absolutely is a connection between those who have been prescribed opioids or opiates and now are not being prescribed them. That's something that, the National Institutes of Health have made clear, and we've heard it from a lot of our local and state leaders as well, that there is also a fear among people that because there is so much scrutiny on doctors, that they may be hesitant to prescribe opioids. I know I've talked to some doctors about that, and they say they are doing what they should be doing. They are prescribing when they should. However, I know there's discussion out there about that. Of course, there anyone who is put into an incarceration or kept away from their, their drug, and it is the kind of drug that had, is an addictive drug. Once they begin to use again, they're going to be less tolerant toward it. So that is definitely a reason that's often pointed to. You know, someone who gets incarcerated and is not given medication-assisted treatment while incarcerated, you know, is going abstinent in jail, and assuming that, you know, they are then released and not immediately provided treatment, they will use again, and they will very likely overdose.
Terry, before we wrap up this conversation, is the heroin crisis having an impact on needle exchange programs? Are we seeing more of those being introduced in the area?
Not in our area. I mean, there's been more and more discussion about it. There seems to be a broader group of public health officials who are saying we need to do it. We are not seeing growth in this, though. Now, interestingly, in Kentucky, outside of northern Kentucky, There are 20 NEO exchanges that have been established since 2015 when it became a law that, you know, allowed for it, and 10 waiting on board. But in Northern Kentucky, the only one we have within the Northern Kentucky Health District is in Grant County. So the most populous counties here do not have exchange yet, and the Cincinnati Exchange Project remains in 4 areas. One of them is in Butler County's Middletown.
Terry, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Cincinnati Inquirer heroine and social issues reporter Terry DeMeo. Coming up, we'll continue our review of local news. You can join us 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. And joining us now, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur and WCPO reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner.
WCPO?
WVXU.
So say, I've never seen you around our newsroom.
you would be good there. You'd be good everywhere,
no,
actually.
I like being on radio.
Thank you for catching that, by the way, Tana. That was Freudian. What was that? You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Pat and Tana, thank you for being here this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you for catching my errors, too. Tana keeps me straight around here. Pat, let's talk first about the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, the agency that runs the Metro bus system in our area. They're taking a long, hard look at their budget right now. And they're projecting a pretty sizable deficit next year. So what's the story here?
Sure. So earlier this week or late last week, I can't quite remember, but they went to the city of Cincinnati saying, we're looking at about a $3 million budget gap for next year.
That's just for next year alone,
right? That's
right.
Yeah. Okay. And it's expected to keep increasing in future years unless there's some sort of changes that are made in sources of funding for them. Earlier this week, City Manager Harry Black told the Transit Authority that they should be able to cover that $3 million for them if they need to, if SORTA needs them to. Now, Dwight Farrell, who heads up SORTA, he's our CEO, he has said that they're still looking at ways to shorten that gap. So it's not – $3 million isn't necessarily a final number that they're coming up short, but if necessary, the cities would be able to cover that gap pending city council approval, of course.
But SORTA is looking at what cuts in service, cuts in certain routes,
yeah,
that kind of thing?
That's basically the message they had for the city was unless we can find this money, we're probably going to look at either service cuts or fare increases or both.
Yeah. And if they can cover it, does that lessen the likelihood of SORTA asking for a countywide sales tax?
And I think there's an argument to think that way, yeah. You know, the whole sales tax levy is such a problematic issue right now because even Democratic Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune, who has traditionally been a huge champion of public transportation projects, he's even gone on record saying that he doesn't think it would pass and it wouldn't get his support if it were put on the ballot.
But no matter what, they're looking at running deficits for a number of years out.
That's right. They've been working on over the course of the last year or so, a long-term plan on how to get back in a more solvent state by within the next 5 years or so. They're still kind of ironing out the details of that plan. But yeah, they're looking like they're in kind of a tough spot right now for the next few years.
Yeah. Now, Tana, you had a story this week at WVXU.org where you're looking at what's going on at the Clifton Cultural Arts Center. And you asked the question, what's next for the Arts Center? So,
well, yeah, it's been sort of a long, long process to get here. You know, the Cultural Arts Center had a $1 a year lease with the Cincinnati Public Schools on their building there in Clifton. And then the school district, they'd been going back and forth and going back and forth. The district saying they need the building back and looking for possible alternatives. So now they've made officially the vote that the school board voted. They're going to take the property back. They've ended the lease. So now the CCAC has 365 days to, you know, wrap up their operations there and find somewhere new to go.
So CPS wants the property back. They're going to, what are they going to use it for?
They'll need to be put in, I think, first and second graders there, maybe some kindergarten. They're going to turn it into a neighborhood school as part of the sort of requirement to build neighborhood schools.
So I guess they figure it's cheaper to do it this way than building a new school.
Well, and yeah, exactly. That's what Mary Ronan said. You know, $14 million to build a new one. Nobody knows exactly how much the CPS is going to have to pay. CCAC, there's this $2 million number that's sort of floating around for all of the capital improvements that the Arts Center has made to the building, such as putting in an elevator. So they'll be reimbursed for those things. But, you know, and then Mary Ronan also pointed out she wasn't even sure where there would be some property to build a new school in the Clifton area.
So they've got 365 days to vacate. Is CPS offering them someplace else to go?
Well, there's been discussions, and I'm not sure the outcome of it. They were supposed to meet earlier this week to discuss this Rawson property, the Rawson Estate, which is right next door to the CCAC. But that is, you know, what, 2,500 square feet, and right now they've got much more square footage. So they're, you know, the director of the CCAC has said that's not really probably a viable solution. At least that's what she had told us earlier in the week.
So for now, they have to. They're going to need a lot of help moving out of there, I take it.
Well, you know, they're going to keep programming and keep doing what they do for now, but also be looking for a new home.
Yeah. Now, Pat, something new for bicyclists and drivers.
That's right.
The 3-foot law. Now, that was passed a little while back, but it just became effective, right?
That's right. It was
in Ohio.
Yes, in Ohio. It's a statewide law. It's actually been a law in Cincinnati for some years. So the way it works is motorists, when overtaking bicycles on the road, they're now required to provide a 3-foot cushion as they're passing, and they cannot pass any closer.
Don't most motorists do that anyhow, though? Don't most of them give you a pretty good leeway?
Well, a lot do. Sometimes they don't. And
you're a bicyclist, so you know this.
Yep, and I can speak firsthand that when a car passes too closely, it will get your heart pumping even more than it already was. But no, you're right to say that probably the average driver, it's in their interest as well to stay clear of a bicycle, and they usually want to. So yes, most drivers probably do.
So now state law says you got to stay at least 3 feet away.
That's right.
And I think most of us would just out of common sense probably stay farther than that unless we just couldn't.
Right, and part of the law is that, you know, it's advocates for it look at it less than as an enforcement tool. Because it would be really difficult to enforce these cases.
That was going to be my question. Yeah.
How would you enforce this?
They happen in real time. You know, there's not necessarily a law enforcement officer around. It kind of turns into a he said, she said kind of thing. So advocates look at it more as an awareness building campaign to get people more aware that cyclists are on the road and, you know, by law, that is where they belong. And, you know, kind of the best way to think about it is just change lanes as you're passing. And even on roads with double yellow lines, that would still be legal in Ohio and Kentucky, actually.
Okay.
To cross a double yellow when you're overtaking a slower vehicle is perfectly legal.
Makes sense. How big a deal is this for the local bicycling community?
You know, we're all happy about it. Myself included, I will say a little safer?
That.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, just any form of increasing awareness and mutual understanding between motorists and cyclists, to me, and I think many would agree, is always going to make one feel safer.
But okay, so the advocates have been pushing for this. They get this passed. What's next?
I actually wrote a column earlier this week that points out three things that cyclists should be kind of thinking about now that this law is in place. One of them is, you know, continue efforts to work to put in protected bike lanes throughout the city, which has been a hot button topic for the last couple years. We have one single protected bike lane along Central Parkway. Another thing is, we're gonna see a lot more push for support for projects like this from city leaders, specifically on the municipal level rather than the state level, because that's where most of these decisions about how to spend money on bike projects. That's where most of it happens, is in City Hall.
Okay. Tana, Cincinnati is starting to plan on becoming a smart city. What does that mean?
That's a good question, Mark. So, yes, there's this whole smart
cities thing.
It means
you don't have hosts who say you're with the wrong organization,
no,
right?
No, okay. That's fine. Okay. We're over that. Okay. No, the smart city thing, what I'm saying there is they brought in somebody to speak at this meeting. They had a little press conference release, and the what happened this week is they've put out a request for people to bid to be bidders, if that makes any sense. So they want you to submit your qualifications. But one of the people who was there to sort of explain the smart city concept started by saying there is no precise definition of what a smart city is. It is whatever you make it to be. And so they're asking people to bid, you know, to show that they're qualified so that, you know, like Mark Haney's technology group doesn't come in and bid and can't actually do any of the things they say they do. So they're not going to waste their time looking at whatever the bid might be.
Tanner knows my abilities with technology, too. So
once they get in and they've got all their qualified bidders, what they'll be looking at doing is the base of this would be a high-speed broadband internet connection that would be built on top of the city's existing infrastructure. So, you know, you already have places to lay that wire. You've got the subway tunnels, for example, where a lot of utilities already run. You've got all of the streetcar infrastructure that's now in, and that's where they really foresee this sort of starting. You've got all of the light poles, all of the...
So the idea is to start it in the urban core.
Any of the city assets that you can, yes, yeah. That you can, where you could put that broadband fiber, you know, the cable or whatever it is, in, and then build on that. So whatever people might be able to imagine that could somehow be better for the city, make government more efficient, make be better, provide better services. So your parking meter could be able to tell you that, hey, I'm on 3rd Street and I'm open. Or, you know, hey, up there's 5 spots over here and people can see that. Or the trash cans are overflowing, come empty us. Just any of these sort of smart technology type of things that could all be connected. And then the idea is there would be a public component, although they can't really say what that would be yet, but some sort of public component, so some kind of access to high-speed internet for the public. We're not sure yet what that entails.
Now, I know Newport has already started down this same line. Did Cincinnati look at them? Do you know if they looked at them as a model?
I'm sure they did, but I can't speak to that precisely. But that is sort of the same thing. Newport's doing it. I believe Columbus is also doing a smart. It's kind of, you know, the new technology. It's the new wave. It's kind of everybody's trying to get there.
And don't hire my technology company. So, have they laid out any kind of a timeline, Tana, for accomplishing this?
You know, they were asking for the qualifications to come in. Once those are in, then they'll do a request for proposals, things like that. Usually take a couple of months each to start doing it. And then they'll go back to city council and start really looking at it.
Okay. Pat, what's new with the streetcar? They just went through a repair on some of the concrete in the tracks, didn't they?
That's right. That was that just got finished yesterday. So service is back to normal. They had suspended streetcar service beginning late Sunday night, for the Central Business District downtown. Only the Over the Rhine portion of the streetcar was still running all week. But yeah, in order to lay 2 new concrete slabs and let that concrete cure, the city decided to shut down service. But that has since been resumed starting today.
Okay, they don't expect anything more to come of this? And
no, they,
not at this point,
know,
at least.
When project managers were speaking with city council about this issue a couple weeks ago, they gave the impression or even said that they don't expect any issues like this. And when I spoke with the city earlier this week, you know, about how they even plan to, you know, regularly maintain concrete. And, you know, the director of transportation, Michael Moore, told me that the little cracks people might see in the concrete along the streetcar line, those are normal.
Nothing to freak out about.
Exactly.
Okay.
Those are shrinkage cracks that happen when concrete is drying and or is now dry and setting. So this was a pretty unique case.
Tana, Northern Kentucky is going to have a new high school that's dedicated to STEAM.
Science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about this. Where is this going to be located?
This is the big promise that Toyota made to the community when they decided to close their North American headquarters over in Erlanger. So their big building there, right off of 275, they're going to give to the Boone County Schools, and they'll turn it into a school of choice. It's going to be a high school, 9 through 12, that will focus on those areas. And students who attend can also come out of high school then with a two-year associate's degree in certain fields as well, that they can kind of, you know, have that jump on going forward or go straight into whatever field that they're looking at.
Have they decided on a name for it yet?
Yes, it will be called the Ignite Institute at Roebling Innovation Center. They made a big deal about it being named after, you know, Roebling of the Bridge fame and his architectural and whatnot.
Gotcha.
That will open for the 2019-2020 school year.
Okay.
So not quite yet. It'll take them a while to
couple years.
Yeah, you have. I mean, what you have here is a manufacturing plant, basically, and headquarters and stuff. It's got a little bit of both in there. And you have to turn that into a learning space as well. So lots of lab spaces, but you also have to have, you know, classroom spaces and things that would make it, you know, a school.
You mentioned it's a school of choice, too.
Is
a school of choice, so is there a tuition or GPA requirements of any kind, or is this just open to anybody?
It's tuition-free. I think that you would still have to be in the Boone County Schools, I would presume, although I guess I shouldn't say that specifically because I don't really know. You know, they'll provide transportation to the school, the Boone County School District will, so just no football team, though.
No football team.
No football team, no marching band, at
although
least not
at this time.
Although
I do understand they're going to have some extracurricular activities.
Yes, exactly. You'll have to, the students will have, the goal, of course, is for every student to have at least one extracurricular, but.
And we got word this week, too, Tana, Taste of Cincinnati is going to have a new place.
Yeah, very exciting. They're going two blocks east. That means
two blocks, okay.
But the thing there is that now the streetcar will be able to run, which originally they had kind of gotten a pass that the streetcar would shut down for events like Taste or Oktoberfest, but it really just makes more sense to have something like that moving.
Yeah, I guess if your ridership would be really high for an event like
exactly.
this.
Exactly, and, you know, Absolutely. They pointed out at yeah. their when they announced they were moving it, that Oktoberfest of last year was the streetcars ridership's top, you know, weekend since it had opened. So, and they didn't want to move down to 2nd and 3rd Street like they moved Oktoberfest because while that worked well for Oktoberfest in September, it would be way too hot and not enough shade. For a May event. So,
Tana and Pat, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. We will continue our local news review with a look at the top business stories of the week and how's your bracket looking, especially when it comes to teams with local ties. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We continue with our local news review. Joining us now, Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Alex, good to see you this afternoon.
Great to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Macy's.
Yes.
Big leadership changes occurring there. Talk about that.
They have a new CEO as of yesterday. That's Jeff Jeanette. He's a protege of Terry Lundgren. Terry had been in the saddle for a very long time, like 13 years. Had a very, very distinguished career. Took over Macy's largest rival, whole bunch of stuff. Seen a lot of... Just seen a ton of transition in the industry, but the last 2 years have been very rough at Macy's. Basically, at the start of 2015, Macy's actually said, "You know what? We're really thrilled with our level of profitability here. Stock's near an all-time high, and I even went further up a bit then." We actually think we're going to grow the top line, the revenues, the sales by, a really healthy clip. And they totally called it wrong. They were looking at consumer data that sort of suggested the consumer was going to spend more money. And instead of buying sweaters, they went out to eat. And they started missing a whole bunch of quarterly projections. And then a hedge fund gets in.
Now, this is Bill Ackman's
hedge fund.
This is a different fellow.
Okay.
But, I mean, they're all kind of the same anyway. This is Starboard Value, and basically they bought a large chunk of the company.
So they get in there, they're applying pressure to Macy's for certain things, I guess, as
you know,
a lot of these hedge funds do.
What these activist hedge funds do, actually Procter has a similar, well, a similar but a smaller problem. I'll tell you about that at some point.
Yeah.
But basically what happens is these hedge funds, they get in, they'll buy like a chunk of the company, maybe 5, 10, 15%. And then suddenly they go, and it's, they'll buy into a company that's had some tough times and the stock's down. And then they suddenly start making friendly or maybe not so friendly suggestions on how to improve the situation. And what happened in this case was Starboard said, you know, Macy's, you're a fine department store operator, but did you realize, and of course they realize this, but you're sitting on, you own almost all your stores, and some of this is incredibly valuable real estate. In fact, it's $21 billion in assets to our reckoning. That's worth more than the actual value of the company itself. And they actually were like pressing to sort of get them to break off all their real estate holdings into a separate company at one point. And then the idea would be that they would lease the property back from this affiliated company, and somehow that would magically unleash all this wealth and shareholder value. And Macy's didn't like that. They like to control their real estate because then they can redesign, they can do whatever they want without asking anybody's permission. And so there was... But over the last couple of years, to mollify investors in general, Macy's has been selling off little pieces of its real estate holdings to raise money. They've raised something like $800 million, you know, from selling off some flagship operations. They've also been reconfiguring or selling off pieces of stores in certain markets to sort of free up cash. To sort of show, hey, we are taking these concerns seriously. You know, we hear you. We're going to do this. We think some of these are okay ideas, so we'll explore it, that sort of thing. But the bottom line is this economy has left a lot of consumers not – it's left a lot of people behind. Retail right now is just in a terrible place right now. Macy's has performed very well for a number of years, but things are not going to turn around tremendously until the economy improves a little bit.
So it sounds like, Alex, that you know, they have new leadership at Macy's. Some of the pressure is off from the hedge fund.
Well, actually, that's very interesting. Last week, about 10 days ago, two things happened. Bam, bam, right in a row. About a month ago, things got really interesting at Macy's. The stock started zipping all over the place because of this. There were reports by news outlets in New York, unnamed sources, but it was credible, basically saying that there was a flirtation between Macy's and the owner of Saks, a company called Hudson's Bay, out of Toronto, Canada. It was an interesting thing because Macy's is a huge company, and this company is about a fifth the size, I think, of Macy's. And there was talk of this small company taking over Macy's, and there was very quickly it got. It became very troubled because it was apparent that, you know, wait a minute, this smaller company is not in a lot better shape than Macy's. How do you combine two of these companies and suddenly it's better than them apart? And there wasn't any money to finance the deal. The only way it was a bit of a concern for Macy's, because the only way you could ever bankroll successfully a deal like that would be you'd have to borrow a whole bunch of money to take over Macy's, and then you'd have to chainsaw a whole bunch of operations, like, I don't know, 200-300 stores or whatever, to pay back the money to reap the return on the investment. Otherwise, you're just combining two struggling operations together, and you're not doing anything. You're paying a whole bunch of money for that, which doesn't make any sense. Anyway, last week, the smaller company Hudson Bay starts flirting with Neiman Marcus, which is a much smaller company. Buying out Macy's, you'd need to pay up $16 billion. At least,
they're looking at somebody who's more in their price range at this point.
Yes, yeah. And it's a much more doable deal, and Neiman Marcus would be a better fit for the parent company of Saks anyway. It's more of a like peer, that sort of thing. And then the day after that, suddenly sources disclose that the hedge fund has sold its stake out of Macy's. They're no longer there. They're no longer there to meddle. They're no longer
so Macy's is suddenly free of all this pressure. And so what?
They're still having problems.
But what's next? I mean, where do they head from here?
Well, also last week, Jeff Jeanette gives his first public comments in quite a while, and sort of starts outlining some of the challenges and the issues facing Macy's. They were interesting. He was kind of pulling his punches, though, in his comments, because he doesn't have the big chair yet 10 days ago. He has it now. But he starts hinting at, I think I'm going to really sort of pursue installing a lot more of these last act sections. Actually, they're in most stores. But I'm also going to really roll out these Macy's backstage sections in the stores. Now, Terry Lundgren is revered in retailing, but the biggest criticism, 2020 hindsight now, by a lot of experts is, you know what, the one thing he never did really, never really got to doing during his tenure was he was very slow to react to the off-price phenomenon. So the TJ Maxx's, the Nordstrom Racks, that sort of, those retailers, those guys have cleaned up in the last 10, 15 years. They've just become a complete force to be reckoned with in apparel. Meanwhile, department stores are, you know, they're struggling. They're all bound to these malls, all that stuff. Wrong price points.
They get a lot of adapting to do, don't they?
Yeah. So basically what's happening, the implication of Jeanette's comments is that he's going to try to beat them by joining them a little bit in their own game.
Yeah.
He's basically, it's kind of back to the future, because back in the day, department stores, the term bargain basement comes from department stores who used to have a cheap floor where they put all their clearance
stuff. And I remember those as a kid.
Exactly.
We had a lot of them downtown. Yeah. You'd walk down in the basement, you'd find things that were your closeout stuff, your clearance stuff, and you would get it a lot cheaper. So the possibility they move in that direction then.
They're doubling the Macy's backstages in their stores this coming year. That's the plan. And the implication is that they might be doing a lot more of that in the future.
We mentioned Bill Ackman.
Yes.
And you were starting to talk about pressures on Procter & Gamble,
well,
I believe,
Procter
as well.
Procter & Gamble had an experience. I actually ran into Bill Ackman a few weeks ago here in Cincinnati, and he was like, oh, no, I'm not doing anything. I'm not going to take over Procter & Gamble or anything. You know, that sort of thing. There is another hedge fund 5 years after Bill Ackman had his run at Procter. There's another one, Trian, that is doing a similar situation with Procter. Procter's still in turnaround. They're trying to grow sales. It's tough. They've got lots of macroeconomic stuff working against them. There's a lot of moving parts. Here's the thing, though. I mean, they've got a $3 billion stake in Procter & Gamble. And if they had a stake like that in Macy's, you know, Macy's would be, or any company like Macy's, they would own something akin to about a third of the company. I mean, $3 billion really buys you a lot of clout in that sort of situation.
But not so in Procter & Gamble's case.
Procter & Gamble is one of the 15 or 20 most valuable corporations on the planet. It is huge. Its market capitalization is something like, I haven't looked at it today, but it's like $240 billion. That's larger than the economy of New Zealand or Ukraine.
And Bill Ackman assures you he's not up to anything with Procter & Gamble.
He doesn't have any stake in it. But Trian, though, does. But again, it's a lot of money to find in a parking lot in a brown paper bag. But compared to P&G's total value, it's basically, what this hedge fund's doing is it's waiting to see how the turnaround progresses some more, and if they stumble, then they could potentially rile up other investors and, I don't know, provoke some additional actions or something like that. Yet to be seen, though.
Real quickly, too, Alex, they're cutting prices on razor blades, aren't they?
Yes, Gillette's. They are. That is actually that was the big news that came out of their big annual. There's a huge consumer products analyst meeting that happens down in Florida every year, mm-hmm. and that was the big headline out of that for Procter. They are what
I guess they have the competition mm-hmm. from these companies like Dollar Shave Club and places like that. I guess it's catching up with them.
They don't like to admit it, but the fact that they're doing that means that they're taking this seriously. This is now they're not cutting prices across the board. What they're doing is they price their razors according to many tiers and many size packages. So they were gonna cut prices for some of those products, I believe, by as much as 20% in some spots, but that's not across the board. But nonetheless, it's a serious acknowledgement of the competition that's out there, and they're trying to protect their market share.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge. Xavier pulled off a big upset last night, beating Arizona in the men's NCAA basketball tournament. And the Musketeers are in the Elite Eight for the first time since 2008. And the Kentucky Wildcats have a tough game tonight against UCLA. Sports reporter and WCPO.com contributor Shannon Russell joins me right now. And hi, Shannon.
Hi, how are you?
Did you stay up until, almost 1 o'clock in the morning watching that game?
Oh, goodness. I was up till about 4:30 a.m., just writing off of the game and kind of trolling around Twitter to see what everyone was saying about it.
Yeah, that was amazing. I'm very impressed. I wanted to get your thoughts on, do you think a lot of people miss this with Xavier? I mean, I never would have expected him to go this far.
No. If you would have asked Chris Mack even 6 games ago, he would have been surprised. I think this team had so much adversity, so many injuries, so many issues throughout the year that they never had a chance to really peak. And so when their season was on the line, when an NCAA tournament bid was on the line, they really pulled it together. And now they're finally playing their best basketball.
So they're getting hot at the right time. Is that an accurate, fairly accurate cliche?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, they were the last team to get a bye in the tournament. They were so close to being a first four team in Dayton, and yet here they are, and they're playing in the Elite Eight for the first time since 08.
And then they're going to play Gonzaga, tomorrow, right?
Correct. Tomorrow evening, 6:09 Eastern.
Then you got a huge game that's coming up for UK tonight. They'll be taking on UCLA. This is a 2-seed UK versus a 3-seed UCLA in the region. So, how do you see that game shaping up?
Well, they played each other in the regular season, and that was a game that Kentucky lost. So, I think that a big key will be how Kentucky defends the perimeter. If they are able to keep UCLA from, hitting 10 three-pointers, and that will change the complexion of the game. But in a game as tight as this, in a stage as big as this, anything could happen between these two teams.
Shannon, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Sports reporter and WCPO.com contributor Shannon Russell